Welcome to QualityCast North, a podcast dedicated to showcasing healthcare quality improvement across Northern British Columbia. Our podcast is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI. PQI is a flagship program that the Specialist Services Committee, which is a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC, with representation from local health authorities. We are casting to you today from the traditional territory of the Kleidlay-Tené First Nation. And hosting today's episode are Dr. Shir Chewy and myself, Deanna Danskin.
To round off Series 3, we have a special episode for you today, tinged with a little sadness, but also some happiness too. Sadness because after 3 seasons, our podcast producer and co-host, Deanna Danskin, is leaving us. But happiness too, as she's moving on to greater things and a provincial lead role in quality improvement with the Doctors of BC. So congratulations to you, Deanna.
Thank you.
And so today, we thought we'd look back through our first 3 seasons of the podcast, and I asked Deanna to pick out 3 episodes which were highlights for her, and we're going to put her in the hot seat today as I ask her about her choices. But before we go through your top 3, Deanna, you were involved in setting up QualityCast North from the very beginning. And so I'm going to start by asking you, how has the whole podcasting experience been? How have things changed from your perspective since our very first episode aired back in November 2021?
Well, it's been really fun doing a podcast, kind of an interesting experience that I certainly wasn't expecting to help co-create and produce and co-host a podcast when I first joined the Physician Quality Improvement team. I mean, it's just one sort of piece of many things I do to support the physicians, but it's been a really fun and interesting experience that not a lot of people get to do. And it's been really cool using a relatively new technology. I mean, now in 2024, there's many, many podcasts and a lot of people are using the medium, but even back in 2021, it hadn't really been utilized and still is not very, I guess, used for our context, you know, healthcare and quality improvement. So yeah, it's been really cool to use kind of a new type of media to share all the successful work that people are doing. And then how have things changed? Well, I mean, when we first started this, we actually did it in a production studio. So that was fun, but it was also COVID. So, you know, we had to kind of like wear masks until we got into our seats. And there was all that we have sort of evolved away from now that we're sort of coming out the other side of COVID, I guess. That said, the actual, I think, spirit of the podcast has kind of stayed true to the sort of the original plan of just basically giving physicians an opportunity to share their work and who they are and kind of their unique perspectives about practicing in the North.
I absolutely agree with you. It's been a real adventure, hasn't it? Just setting out this, not really knowing how things were going to pan out when we started. But did you ever think that we'd get to this point with 3 seasons under our belt and over 4,000 downloads in over 26 countries?
To be honest, no, but I didn't really have any expectations. I was like, it's a new thing. We'll try it, see how it goes. I mean, in the spirit of quality improvement, you do small tests, small trials and see how it works out. So I remember the first actual time we tried to record, I think there was some problem with the scheduling and we kind of had it booked and nobody got back to us. And then, so we had to reschedule and it seemed a little bit like it might not work out. But then we ended up getting, I believe it was 3 physicians in the first recording episode. And then from that, it kind of grew to 6. And next thing you know, we had 10 full episodes and a full season in the first year. And it ended up getting, you know, such positive reviews and people were excited about it and it seemed popular that we were able to roll that into 2 more episodes and also sort of expand the types of guests and types of information we're sharing on the podcast. So you'll recall when we first started, it was very specific to quality improvement projects and we kind of expanded it into, you know, folks that were in leadership roles or sort of broader quality related supports like the college or electronic medical records. So I think that's kind of been interesting how it's evolved. And also, we've also expanded to include physicians not exclusively practicing in the North, so a little bit more of that provincial lens. Yeah, and it's cool seeing it reach so many different countries. That's really interesting.
It is. And I'm constantly surprised, actually, when I hear about people through people who have listened to the podcast, from across the country, from far afield. And it's been a wonderful medium to be working with. Okay, Diana. Well, let's go through your list of favorites now. So from season one, you chose Dr. Wumi Iyoremi's episode, All Bodies Are Good Bodies, Overcoming Weight Bias in Primary Care. Now, why did you choose this one?
So I was reflecting on this being quite a meaningful and favorite episode. So there's kind of two reasons. This particular episode has always been, and it still is to this day, one of our most downloaded and most listened to episodes. So what I really like about this one is I think it has a lot of appeal, not just to physicians, but patients and the public as well. So it's a very, I think, topic of interest for a lot of different audiences. And I think that's kind of what you're going for when you're creating a podcast, is you want that universal appeal. And I think the topic itself, I think, is very important for a couple reasons. One, it really supports that improvement of equity for certain populations. And that's what quality improvement's about. It was really interesting hearing some of the statistics that Dr. Wumi shared on this episode about weight bias and patients that are living in larger bodies and some of the barriers they experience to care that can be quite a big problem, whether it's, people not getting appropriate cancer screening and all the repercussions of that, as well as people just not feeling comfortable going to their family doctor or feeling like they can't comfortably sit in a waiting room and how that really impacts both the individual as well as populations. I also really like this project because it included a lot of that self-reflective piece. So it was working with the clinic staff to have folks go into kind of reflecting on their own implicit bias, which we all have. And it's, I think, a big area of work that we can improve on more in healthcare. And she's also very honest about how challenging that work was. And I think it's really helpful to acknowledge that it's hard work, but it really can be helpful to improve the equity of patients. So yeah, I really like this episode. I think it's very, very important. And I hope that more work is done around this and more projects like this in the future.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said there. It was a real, and one of the beauties of this medium is that you can get a topic like this and it can really challenge you, right? It can really challenge you in your own practice to raise your game as well. Well, we've got an excerpt from her interview now to illustrate this. And this is Dr. Wumi Iyoremi talking about what weight bias is and her project in how to address it in her, how she addressed it in her primary care clinic. What is weight bias and why is it a problem, especially in healthcare? And how big do you think this problem actually is?
Thank you for the question. So weight bias refers to the negative attitudes towards others about because of their weight. And then from studies that have been done, different studies, self-report and experimental research has shown that negative stereotypes and attitudes towards obese patients by a range of healthcare providers and fitness professionals, including views that obese patients are lazy, they're lacking in self-discipline and dishonest, and unintelligent, annoying, and non-compliant with treatment. And so these are some of the views that people have had about what people perceive them because of their weight. And so this was by research done by Paul and Broll in 2001, and another research by Help and Hsu found that providers spend less time in appointments and provide less health education with obese patients compared to their slimmer patients. So studies shows that obese patients are less likely to receive age and gender appropriate cancer screening and other preventive medicine, even after adjustment for lower education, income, and even higher burden of the illness. And so we found out that weight stigmatization, which refers to the stereotypes and labels we assign to people who are likely to have obesity as documented as a significant risk factor for depression, low self-esteem, and body dissatisfaction. So how big is this problem? From the Obesity Canada report, 64% of adults with obesity report experiencing weight bias by healthcare professionals. So this is something significant, and it's something we really need to talk about.
Now, you recently led an improvement project on this issue in your practice.
Okay.
What did your project involve, and what did you set out to achieve?
The project involved decreasing weight bias among staff and providers at the Blue Pine Clinic by 20% from the baseline using the Beliefs About Obese Persons scale. So the team of two coaches, a social worker, our team lead, and a dietitian and two family physicians, myself and another one, worked together on the project. And it involved the pre and post survey of the BOAP reports. We had presentations on weight bias, and 12 of us participated.
Now, was the project plain sailing throughout, or did you encounter any difficulties or problems on the way?
The project at the onset was to review weight bias among the patients and even the staff of the clinic. But due to the pandemic and the restrictions, we focused on the staff and the providers. And then hopefully we'll be able to review the weight bias among patients in the future. And we applied for some funding to help provide weight-inclusive equipment, such as gowns, tables, weighing scales, wheelchairs for our patients, but it wasn't approved at that time, but we're still working on it.
And so what were the outcomes of the project? Did you manage to see an improvement?
Yes, we did. Our pre-survey BOAP results in January, before we had a score of 26.59, and our goal was to decrease the average bias by 20%. After the survey, it was 31.9%. So we had a final score of 33.1, which was an improvement of 24.5 instead of the 20 we set out to do. So that was great for us. And we created weight-inclusive posters too to create awareness about the clinic's support for weight management and discussion around it. We also introduced the use of the Edmonton Obesity Scoring Scale to measure health as we move from weight to health. You know, Obesity Guideline 2020 guideline talks more about the shift from weight to health, which with the BMI, we can't do much of that. We just categorize people. But the EOSS talks more about the different stages of where people are in regards to their health. So we started using that. And from the baseline in January, we hardly used that EOSS report. But by the 25th of May, we had about 25 people have already completed that in their patient chat. So that is significant for us.
Yeah, that's a great result. Looking back on the project, were there any lessons learned, do you think? And if you had to do it again, would you have done anything differently?
Yes, the lessons learned is the importance of teamwork in implementing a project. Very important. And, you know, people will come in to share their ideas, perspectives about things, and really it helped. Because, for example, the use of the scale, the OSS scale, posters and all that, we didn't set to do that out from the project, but people's ideas, bringing it in, you know, was something that's really important. And then some of the videos triggered some emotions in some of our staff. And so in future, we'll have to screen some materials before we use them and also let people know, aware of the content, if they are comfortable with it or not. So those are some of the lessons I learned.
Now, I understand you received some assistance on your project from the Northern Health and Doctors of BC Physician Quality Improvement Initiative. Can you tell us how this initiative helped you?
The QI training sessions were a great learning opportunity for me. It provided training and hands-on experience and commitment to quality improvement in healthcare, and that's one of my passions. So it was really helpful for me personally. And also the project created a practical experience platform, not just the theory of QI for me, you know, going through the sessions and doing the project at the same time, you know, was something I really appreciated. And the coaches were also very supportive, Laura Palmer and Bonnie Mercedes at that time. were supportive throughout the projects. I didn't feel alone. You know, the support they gave me really helped to make sure that this project went on smoothly. And still now, Laura continues to provide assistance in documentations and presentations in regards to the project.
Lastly, Rumi, on the topic of quality improvement, what does the term quality healthcare mean to you?
You know, when I said, what is quality improvement? To me, it's an all-inclusive, holistic care, equitable care that promotes the well-being of patients and the healthcare professionals, irrespective of their socioeconomic background, culture, race, or gender.
Now, for your second choice, Deanna, from season two, you chose Dr. Tiffany Wong, Is It a True Penicillin Allergy? And her project on penicillin allergy delabeling. So talk us through this choice.
Yeah, so this is a really cool project. And for those of you that maybe have not had an opportunity to listen to the episode, Dr. Tiffany Wong is actually a pediatric allergist practicing in Vancouver at PHSA, so at the Children and Women's Hospital. And we brought her on the podcast because this was a very successful SPREAD project. So it's something that started, I think she actually started it as a physician quality improvement, one of the earlier cohorts down in the Lower Mainland. And it was such a well-executed project and such a important and sort of, I think, accessible for a lot of different applications in medicine that it's been spread to a lot of different locations throughout the province, including here at UHMBC in Prince George. And more specifically, I really like this project because I'm a little bit biased. So my history before I became a quality improvement coach, quality improvement person, is that once upon a time, I worked in a microbiology lab. And then I became a regional quality manager and did a lot of work around antimicrobial stewardship, like from the lab perspective. And inappropriate use of antibiotics was always kind of near and dear to my heart. It's actually a huge issue for like a global health and like global population health. You know, it's kind of scary to think that maybe in 20 years we might not have antibiotics that work anymore. And, you know, I think it's often overlooked in favor of more sort of, I guess, like flashier projects in acute care. So it was kind of a bit validating that this project got so much traction. And I also really enjoyed Dr. Tiffany Wong's framing of this project, because on the face of it, I think, you know, penicillin allergy, it doesn't actually really sound that interesting or that, you know, important to the broad sphere of healthcare, but she had a really, really excellent patient-oriented story that went along with this project that really framed how important this is for patient safety. And actually giving people inappropriate antibiotics can lead to a whole slew of really, really bad side effects. And her example was, and it was a true story of a pediatric patient who had, you know, all this really awful stuff happen because they had this incorrect penicillin allergy on their chart. And so really, it's a really quite impactful project. And if you can avoid those patient safety issues in the future, for whether it's pediatric or elderly patients or adults, it's actually going to be better patient outcomes and probably save the healthcare system a lot of money. So again, it's one of those things where it's a real win for quality improvement because it's a kind of a small change with actually big impacts when you can apply it to a whole system. So yeah, it's a really, really interesting project. And Dr. Tiffany Wong, she's very articulate and well-spoken, and it's a really great one to listen to. So yeah, that's why I chose that as one of my favorites.
Yeah, I agree. This was a really, really good project. And it's a testament to the quality of the project when it begins to organically spread, right, without much additional input required, without sort of pushing it too hard. The fact that it spread very, very organically and on its own really tells you that it's a high quality project and meets a real need.
Well, I was just going to add to this. I think that's a really good point too, because this particular project, I've heard, just like it pops up in conversation when physicians hear about this. They'll just make little comments like, that is so great. I cannot stand it when you have these like inappropriate allergies. Like I just, it drives me crazy. And I wish there was something we could do about it. And yeah, by actually implementing these testing clinics and actually making an intentional effort to get these incorrect allergies off of people's charts. Like it's one of those also those minor frustrations that's also an intangible that I think will make a lot of physicians, even like this is what I hear from family physicians. They're like, oh yeah, just love to get this off of those patient charts. So makes people's jobs less frustrating, which helps nowadays.
Always in favor of that. And here's Tiffany Wong talking about the perils of incorrect penicillin allergy labeling and her delabeling project.
So let's turn now to the actual topic of penicillin allergy delabeling, which was the topic of your improvement work. So reported penicillin allergy is surprisingly common in our population. A lot of people will say that they are allergic to penicillin and they have an allergy. So what is delabeling? What does that mean? And why is there a need for this?
I think it's important to provide some background when discussing the topic. Available literature indicates that roughly 10% of the North American population thinks they have a penicillin allergy. I did some quick math before the podcast, and if we're converted to British Columbia numbers, that's about 500,000 patients. But if these patients are assessed by an allergist, we know that well over 90% of these patients are not truly allergic. So there's this huge gap in accuracy. Most patients and physicians typically note the allergy and simply choose an alternative medication. Penicillin allergy delabeling involves proactively identifying these patients labeled as allergic and trying to figure out who can safely receive the penicillin and other beta-lactam antibiotics. So we talk a lot about penicillin allergy, but truthfully, we're talking about a group of penicillin medications, and that includes the beta-lactams.
So what is the potential impact for a patient with an incorrectly diagnosed penicillin allergy? So I know Dr. Chui in the introduction mentioned it might be less efficacious, but there's obviously safety concerns too about using a different type of drug that might have more side effects or, negative impacts on the patient. So I'm just wondering if you could expand on that.
Absolutely. A lot of people feel it is safer to avoid something they might be allergic to, in this case, penicillin, and just choose an alternative. The truth is there are a lot of concerns with this approach. Alternative antibiotics are associated with increased risk of side effects. And there's also a wealth of evidence indicating that penicillin allergy labels are associated with poorer care in hospitals, poor health outcomes, and increased healthcare costs. As an example, actually early in my career, I saw a 10-year-old who had been diagnosed with a penicillin allergy as a toddler. Then when she was 8, she developed a streptococcal infection and instead of receiving penicillin, received an alternative medication called clindamycin. She went on to develop a side effect of C. diff colitis and had such severe diarrhea that she needed an ICU admission because of renal failure associated with hypotension and fluid loss. So this case really left an impression on me because it may have been preventable if she had been given the first line antibiotic. And that really launched a lot of the work that I do today.
Yeah, that's a very interesting patient story and something obviously we want to avoid for people because it sounds really, really quite serious. I'll just add, I used to work in the lab. Actually, I worked in microbiology for many years. And when we do the testing, if someone is allergic to penicillin, it usually can take up to 1 or 2, even 3 more days to test for different antibiotics. So again, it's an unnecessary addition of time to getting people the appropriate therapy.
Of course, and the cost of doing those tests as well.
Yeah, so it's a lot bigger of a system issue than I think we initially first realize. So when you're doing this delabeling, what is the actual process for delabeling someone's assumed allergy to penicillin?
The first step of penicillin allergy delabeling is identifying the patients with the label. We try to do this proactively instead of at the time when the patient needs the medication. When patients with the allergy labels are identified, then we proceed to interrogate the label by taking an accurate medical history. The history we obtain in terms of timing and symptoms allows us to assess the risk of a true allergy. If a patient is deemed to be higher risk, we conduct specialized skin testing to confirm the allergy. And for everyone else who is low risk or really no risk at all, or population risk. And skin testing is not required, and a simple oral test dose will suffice. If the test dose is tolerated, labels of allergy are removed from patient records, and this can be in paper or electronic charts, and in a variety of settings, including hospitals, community clinics, and pharmacies as well.
So let's turn to your quality improvement project a little bit now, which is a slight tangent on the actual process of delabeling. What was the problem with penicillin allergy delabeling that you set to address with your quality improvement project?
The overarching challenge I've seen has been knowledge translation and practical application of penicillin allergy delabeling into BRISI practice settings. I had done an environmental scan when I first started this work about 8 years ago. Many healthcare providers were aware that the rate of false allergy labels was really high, but most people did not feel knowledgeable enough to confidently assess the patients or approach delabeling on their own. And I think this is because of our medical and healthcare training. Historically, we've all been taught that if someone has an allergy, you should avoid it, especially if it's a drug allergy. And this meant that patients continued to get alternative antibiotics or were languishing on very long wait lists to see an allergist. And by the way, allergists are all clustered in the Lower Mainland, so patients were needing to travel in addition to the wait time, which is less than ideal.
So how did you set about trying to correct this issue with capacity and education?
I knew that it would be really hard to change practice without any real evidence-based tools. So we started at BC Children's Hospital in our allergy clinic with a study to develop and validate a structured questionnaire and clinical algorithm for the patients we saw consults on for beta-lactam allergy. Then we expanded it to a proactive delabeling program on the inpatient pediatric and oncology wards in our hospital. I worked with some other physicians to publish Canadian guidelines based on that data and questionnaire on penicillin allergy delabeling. And during the initial development of the clinical algorithm and application of it during the study, it occurred to me that it'd be really great to be able to automate the algorithm somehow and give other healthcare providers the confidence to approach assessments on their own. I know that healthcare providers are really busy and not everyone wants to go digging for an article and apply a manual algorithm. And that was the basis of what we've done with our electronic algorithm. It's taken us a few years and a lot of learning and a lot of PDSA cycles, but we've worked with the antimicrobial stewardship mobile platform called FirstLine to develop a point of care risk assessment and management tool that virtually any healthcare provider can access and apply to their patients as long as they have internet access. It only takes a few minutes for the tool to guide practitioners through the key questions required to assess risk, and providers can feel confident using it because it's a validated algorithm. It's been really exciting to see the growth of the tool. It's been adopted in multiple health authorities in our province and in other provinces in Canada as well. We've been working closely with Dr. Sainchuk and Dr. Olson, as well as Alicia Ray here, who's an AMS pharmacist at UHNBC, to create a penicillin allergy delabeling program and clinic, and it's been really exciting.
And finally, from season three, you chose Dr. Darren Jakubek and his project on ketamine infusion therapy for refractory depression. Now, why did this one stand out for you, Deanna?
So this particular project and Darren's description of his work stood out, I think, for two reasons. One, this project and his work on it was very, very patient-oriented. So he sought out patient partners to help sort of design the project. Also included a patient advocate to do some work around communicating the results. And just the overall approach to the project really was about providing a service to patients that were struggling to get treatment for their depression because nothing was working. And it really was in support of the patient, not only to, you know, get treatment for this clinical depression they were dealing with, but there was a lot of really good feedback from patients who really were grateful for the process, and also, you know, shared things like how it helped them get back to work and, you know, help them kind of get back to normal life in a way. And I think having that as a focus of some of your results for a project is really powerful. And I really appreciated hearing about that side of things, and not just, you know, and there was data, but, you know, it's not just the data around, you know, wait times and referral numbers and that sort of thing, which is also important. But I really liked the patient-centeredness of this project. And then the other thing I really appreciated about this was that it was really forward-thinking, I think, in terms of introducing a relatively new service, a relatively new innovation into the sort of clinical toolkit for supporting patients with depression. You know, Dr. Jacobit had shared that he heard about this ketamine infusion and that it could be successful. And he, you know, did his homework, made sure that he was able to do it as, you know, as part of his, you know, professional scope of practice. It was legal, it was safe, there was a protocol, and it didn't seem like patients were able to access it. So he kind of made that happen. And I think that's something that we're challenged with a lot in healthcare, is that there's these new treatments, new innovations that are actually, you know, they're standardized, they're on label or whatever you would call it. But it's just a matter of someone making the move to have it be part of the standard care that's accessible for patients. And so I think it's really kind of refreshing and inspiring to hear people doing that as part of a project. Because, you know, I mean, if somebody doesn't kind of take that on and take that motivation to at least try to bring something new and innovative, you know, we'd probably never have like these kind of exciting new changes. So those are kind of my two appreciations I had for Dr. Jacobuk's ketamine infusion project.
Yeah, this was a nice one. And you can, when you hear Dr. Jacobit talk about his work, you can really sense that focus he has on his patient and how much they really appreciated that service that he was providing. So here's Dr. Jacobit now talking about his quality improvement work on ketamine infusion therapy for refractory depression.
So I see ketamine as a dissociative agent, similar to psilocybin or LSD or some of these other ones that are out there in that category, as opposed to, roughly speaking, a stimulant or a depressant. So it's one of the medications that can get you out of your head. And I hadn't always been an advocate, or this hadn't been on the top of my mind for a long time. And it's me using the word dream is not, it's not related to this. It's literally, I actually work with people's nighttime dreams as a form of self-reflection. And I have for 15 years, and it's something that I do myself. And I've either hosted or co-facilitated 7 retreats in Smithers and been to 8 other retreats internationally, and part of a larger group of people that work with nighttime dreams as a form of self-reflection. And I found it changes people's lives in a significant way and gets them out of their head and into their body, into their intuition, into their emotions and their feelings. And it speaks the language of therapy and self-reflection. And I just stumbled into ketamine as an option. I knew people went to retreats and did things like ceremonies with peyote and other things. And it's just one of those things I anecdotally heard. And then I read the Michael Pollan's book on how to change your mind. And he helped just give me a bit of words about intention setting. And I thought, goodness, I'd heard that ketamine could be used for this purpose. And in my experience, it is indeed a dissociative agent, which is one that will open up all feelings. It's not necessarily going to make you happy or make you sad, or like alcohol is a depressant or cocaine being a stimulant. It will open up to all feelings. And it was this potential to open somebody up to their feelings that could have true healing capacity. So I'd read and I'd heard about this, and luckily Northern Health already had a protocol that was legal to do infusions for pain if you're an anesthetist or if you have anesthesia training. And I thought, goodness, there's already a protocol. I'm an anesthetist. It's legal. It's above board. And people were already asking me to do this because they knew I already thought about mental health in a different way. And in my pain clinic, I virtually never prescribe anything. And in my dream clinic, I don't prescribe anything. How do we do things with less pharmaceuticals? How do we do things in such a way that we can treat things as a ceremony, set an intention? And if I did a ketamine project, how would I set it up in such a way that it was a healing ceremony and could be used with people with mental health issues, just as I had used nighttime dreams, possibly as an accelerant? So I had a lot of language around this and talked to other people who had done this, and that was my approach. So I've given you a rather scattered approach to where I am, but I think it's necessary to say how I came to this. And I mean, I've worked with a lot of people's nighttime dreams, and I know a lot of the language of the inner journey. So when somebody has a hallucination or what they call a bad trip, I can easily reword that into other means and help people hold their hand as they go to very difficult and dark places. So I have a lot of experience with this. There's there's a scattered approach to your question, and I could talk a lot longer on that, but I needed to rein it in a bit. And that's where the quality improvement sort of process really, really helped me along. Yes. So my team, Lee Cameron, who was the Northwest a representative and knowledgeable person, was invaluable for orienting me, and pointed out that I had team members in. It's been said that I did this program off the side of my desk, despite it being very well done, I believe, and I think it's largely true, because we didn't have program status. But there was one interested person in our OR booking department, Joan, and she made binders and liked this project and knew somebody in the program, and it sparked her interest. So she would help, even though it was within our operating room that we do our bookings with, that's the way we booked people. And they said, okay, through the ketamine program. And I teamed with the head nurse in the operating room to take some of her nurses to sit with the whoever was interested in mental health. And then the head nurse, because one of our infusion nurses was interested, and we used the infusion room. And then my two GP anesthetist colleagues, I got them interested so they could be present for these, as we did them every Monday and Wednesday. So eventually they started learning what I was doing, and they bought in and they quite liked it. And I had one good patient partner in Laura, who had been doing dream stuff with me in the past and had counselors and had been on a long healing journey. And she sat with some people and eventually started facilitating my Zoom meetings with me, which was wonderful, since she'd walked the walk. And it tends to be women who open these doors more, and sometimes I was just aware that it's nice to have some, be it right or wrong or misconceived or not, have some female presence. And sometimes I'd walk away from the Zoom meeting and think, is there some things that are just easy to say to other women? I'm just aware that I'm a man in a world that there's very many men that open this door, which is a whole topic that's different altogether. But yeah, and team members slowly grew as other nurses and then other patients, patient partners wanted to be involved in the Zoom meetings and wanted to set things up. They kept offering to help. And as you're right, if I can answer another part of your question here, and that right off the top, you can say, like, what are you up to? And is this really above board here? And for people that haven't opened the door, have the language of inner journeys or ceremonies, or are used to setting intentions, this can seem like it's a bit out there. And I did, luckily, the psychiatrist, there's one local outpatient psychiatrist who had some clients that went through the program and saw a big difference. And Dr. Abu, she climbed on board and said, I support you, whatever you can do. And I thought that was wonderful. And she became part of my PDSA cycle of honing this down. I thought, how about every single patient needs to see the psychiatrist first? And then it gives me legitimacy. It makes it look a little bit less like I've gone rogue here. And she says, okay, you officially have refractory depression. Oh my goodness. I think that what you just said, people are uncomfortable. I think it's not just with ketamine, but it's, I would argue, it's a mirror for ourselves. Are we willing to be with difficult emotions as Western society, where I'm talking to you from? We don't speak about these sort of things. We don't speak about healing ceremonies in modern medicine, if I want to call it that. So there's a stumbling block in terms of selling this to administration or getting program status, or you tell somebody and they say they want to put you in the infusion clinic with another iron infusion, or why can't we put three people in a room and just churn them through. And that is by far the hardest one, that people are reluctant to climb on board. But other than that, because we didn't have program status, there was no, this was my volunteer time and Joan and the OR booking department's volunteer time. And we stole nurses from other places for 6 hours and 9 hours, the infusion clinic.
So, Deanna, that rounds out your top three favorite episodes. So that's great. Thank you very much for taking us through those. All excellent choices, I might add. Now, what's next for you now? You're leaving the podcast. What's your new role about?
So that's a good question. And I just wanted to note, these are my top three, but it was very hard to decide. There were so many interesting projects and just really dedicated, inspiring physicians and, you know, health authority leaders and staff that we've included on the podcast. So I don't know, I probably could have blabbed on like every episode, but those are my, I guess, top three that stuck out for me. So I will be leaving Northern Health after being here for 12 years to move to a new role with the Doctors of BC. So my new role officially is a provincial liaison with the quality impact team overseeing the spreading quality improvement portfolio. So what exactly I'll be doing, I'm not 100% sure, but basically it's, I think, that overall provincial sort of support for the various health authorities as they're continuing to support the spread of successful quality improvement projects. And whatever that entails, I think a lot of it will be which also sounds fun, reviewing projects and just trying to identify those that have that really high potential for spread.
Well, it sounds like a new adventure in many ways, just like this podcast was at the outset when we first started that. So do you think you'll continue to make podcasts in the future, or have you hung up your microphone for now, do you think?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, taking a break from this podcast and handing over the reins to someone else, but I don't know, podcasting it's pretty fun and there's so much potential to take it in a variety of different directions. So, I mean, I can't say for sure. I'm hoping I will be able to do some podcasting in the future. You know, maybe there's a possibility for, you know, a provincial a provincial offshoot to Quality Cast North. And you know, I don't know, I've also sort of been thinking, I don't really have the free time right now, but maybe in the future, you know, there's obviously, if I have personal interests, maybe I could do a podcast about, not quite sure what that would look like, but I do like storytelling and the potential for storytelling. So the potential's endless. So it's not really a definitive answer.
That's fine. I appreciate it. It was a slightly cheeky question in the first place. So I'll take that as a rain check for the provincial expansion. But thank you for sharing that. And so finally, the question we ask all our guests, of course, and you are no exception, Deanna, but I must ask you this. What do you like about living and working in BC?
Oh, goodness. I mean, it's probably a bit cliche and the same as everyone else on the podcast is answered. I mean, we're very blessed living in BC. And I would also say I'm going to focus on Northern BC because I lived in Northern BC for over 20 years. We're blessed with such amazing opportunities to recreate in nature. So I really enjoy getting outdoors and doing a lot of hiking and skiing and biking and just the diversity of, I guess, nature around us. I was fortunate enough. I mean, I live in Prince George, traditional territory of Clade Lake Tene, but I was fortunate enough to go all the way out to Prince Rupert this weekend. So seeing, you know, the Northwest and the ocean and, you know, the mountains in the Bulkley Valley. And that's just one little slice of where we live. And it's really beautiful. And we're sort of lucky to have that. So I guess what I like about living in BC is the access to all of that amazing nature and the diversity of outdoor experiences. And working, what do I like about working in Northern BC? There's just so many opportunities to meet so many interesting people. I think, you know, people are drawn, I think, to practice in rural places and in the north, again, because they really want to be here. And I think that's really helpful and can create a really good sense of team and community. And yeah, that it's been really great. And so I am moving to a new provincial role, but fortunately, I'm allowed to work remotely from anywhere in BC. So I'm going to stay in the north for now because I do really, really love it here and all the opportunities.
Well, that's well said. Thank you very much. And I agree with you completely. That's a beautiful stretch of the province there between Terrace and Prince Rupert alongside the Skeena River there. So every time I head up there, I feel lucky to enjoy that. Well, Deanna, I'd just like to say it's been fun turning the tables on you today and talking with you, but it's also been an absolute pleasure working alongside you as a producer and co-host at QualityCast North these last 3 years. You've been central to this show since its inception, and you've taken what was just an idea and helped turn it into a successful reality. So I'm sure our listeners will miss you as much as I will. But sadly, here comes the closing music, which means it's our cue to wrap up today's episode and season 3 of QualityCast North. I'll be back in the autumn, hopefully, with season 4 with more great guests and quality improvement work to showcase. But until then, for one last time, Deanna, it's goodbye from your hosts. I'm Cher Chewy.
I'm Deanna Danskin.
Today's episode was hosted and co-produced by Dr. Cher Chewy and Deanna Danskin, with technical support from Matt Walker. Original music by Daniel Chewy and artistic support by Reggie Goodine. Further information on the content of today's episode is available with the show notes on our website, nhpqi.ca. QualityCast North is recorded on the traditional territory of the Clade Lake Tene First Nation. If you enjoyed today's interview, check out our other episodes available on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you find your podcasts.